You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This week's bits. The best news nuggets from Breakfast and The Wire from this week.
Atamariye, ko hana rostoku ingoa, and welcome to this week's bits. This week we saw three really great pieces looking into immigration, the announcement of the end of Mana magazine, and also Spotify being in a bit of trouble. First, let's have a look into the interview BFM's Adam Jacobson did with David Hall, the editor of Fair Borders, Migration Policy in the 21st Century. The book aims to examine various angles on the theme of fair immigration, which is an important conversation to be having when election time is close.
So the book is about borders and the nature of borders today, especially in this time when, you know, nationalism is rising and people have growing concerns about migration and its effects in different parts of the world. And the idea was really to take a bit of an ethical perspective on borders and not to think of them in terms of economics and, you know, what the impact is on GDP, but to think about the effects they have on people, and especially to think through the lens of fairness, because, you know, fairness is a value that New Zealanders often hold themselves to. So I wanted to explore this thought of whether our borders really live up to our own standards of fairness, or whether we're, you know, failing to give a fair go to people who want to enter New Zealand.
Why was it important to put it under the umbrella of fairness? What motivated you to choose this topic?
Well, I think that just gets us thinking about the right things, because borders can have effects on people on either side of a border. You know, they obviously have an effect on people who want to enter a country, because, you know, borders can create all sorts of restrictions and they can select people and they can impede their movement. But borders also have an effect on people inside of a country, because if borders aren't well regulated, there can be impacts for the communities that migrants are entering. So, yeah, fairness gets us thinking about how we can set up our borders in a way that we can all kind of agree that they do provide a fair go, you know, that they're not overly cruel to people on the outside of the borders, but also not overly cruel to people on the inside of borders.
Throughout your investigation into border fairness, what was kind of the conclusion that you drew from modern immigration policy? Are the current standings that we have, are they fair?
I think that the one problem with this is that our borders and our migration policy is just made up by a whole range of different visas and visa streams. So the question about fairness always comes back to which visa stream, which mode of entry that you're talking about. So, for instance, Murdoch Stevens writes a chapter in the book about the refugee quota, and, you know, he makes the case that that isn't fair at all, because New Zealand is not pulling its weight in regard to offering resettlement opportunities for refugees around the world. Our quota is notoriously low by international standards. So that, for instance, is not a fair border. You know, another one that's in the news is the PTE scheme, the for private training establishments, and, you know, a lot of people are coming in and to some extent they're being misled about the opportunities in New Zealand. They're sometimes vulnerable to exploitation. So that's not fair either. It's neither fair for the people entering, and it's neither fair for New Zealanders. So yeah, it really always just comes back to which visa you're talking about.
For politicians who are currently writing out policy, what are the key considerations which you think they should include when thinking of creating fair immigration policies?
Yeah, I think the key thing really is getting away from the simplistic notion of migration as a sort of a cause and effect thing, because there's this notion, you hear it all the time in this language about turning off the tap or stopping the flood, this sort of notion of migration as a fluid which is just going to pour in and have these effects. But I think migration it doesn't cause social issues so much as interact with them. And, you just have to be really careful and really sophisticated in the way you think about how these things are going to play out. You know, for instance, the Labour Party has proposed regulating the PTE industry, which I talked about earlier, and there's all sorts of good reasons for better regulating that area, as I alluded to. But the problem is that sometimes there's an assumption there that by reducing the immigration in that sector, that that'll somehow have an effect on Auckland housing and transport. But of course, the migrants coming in on the PTE scheme, by definition, are not well-heeled, not well-resourced people. They're certainly not going to be buying houses, very unlikely to be buying cars. They're much more likely to be, you know, renting and possibly living many, many people to a room and using public transport instead. So it's not obvious that you can address issues like transport and housing by way of fixing issues in a visa like that. So you just have to be really careful about those lines of cause and effect.
Last week, it was announced that the production of Mana magazine would be put on hold indefinitely by its owner, Mana Productions, who say, at this stage, they do not intend to continue publishing it. For the past 3 years, the magazine's license has been held by Ko-Fi Media, who employed journalist Leonie Hayden as its editor. But this month, the license returned to Mana Productions. BFM's India Isso spoke with former editor Leonie Hayden about the importance of Mana magazine, Ko-Fi's unsuccessful bid to buy the title, and her new project with the spin-off.
What's your understanding of the reasons that Mana Productions is no longer publishing the magazine?
So, yeah, when Ko-Fi Media took over the license to publish Mana, we agreed that we'd sort of start negotiations 6 months before that license ran out to try and purchase the title. So that happened 6 months ago. We made an offer to Mana Productions on behalf of Ko-Fi Media. We made an offer based on the small amount of profit that we'd been able to turn over that 3 years or 2.5 years, plus a little bit more. And it was a reasonable offer, and it was certainly a lot more than a lot of magazines sell for these days. I myself once worked for a magazine that ended up being sold for $1. So we thought we were offering quite a good price, but we had our offer rejected. You know, and that's their right to reject their offer, I guess. But we were also aware, based on, you know, working in publishing and knowing that environment quite well, that there was no other publishing company in New Zealand that would make a similar offer. Because, you know, with a title that niche as well, requires certain skills and sensitivities. And even if you're sort of asking, you know, if you're asking Māori organisations, which is what the Mana Productions are now sort of doing, like casting the net wider and saying Māori organisations should step up and buy this title, which is all well and good if all he wants is more money, but at the end of the day, you still require a publishing company to publish that magazine. You know, not just anyone can do it, and I think that maybe sounds arrogant, but you know, you need a fire station to put out fires, you need, you know, people who know how to do a job to do the job. You can't just sort of buy a magazine and then all of a sudden you know how to publish a magazine. So we genuinely thought we were the best people for the job, and we made an offer that reflected our respect for the title as well as what it was actually worth in the current market, and it was rejected.
Right, because I read that Ko-Fi's director said that, yeah, Mana did perform well. Obviously, it's very tough for magazines at the moment.
Yeah.
So what would you say that were its strengths that allowed it to do so well?
So the person that would have been quoted is the director of Ko-Fi Media, which is James Frankham. And frankly, he was what allowed it to perform so well. Ko-Fi Media owns New Zealand Geographic, and he bought that magazine after their owners had announced that they would stop publishing it. And he is just a really smart, resourceful, enterprising guy who knows how to turn a magazine into an ecosystem, if that makes sense. Because you can no longer just publish a magazine. You know, you've got your bigger players like Bauer and Fairfax and whatnot, and APN, who, in order to stay afloat, they have to publish many magazines to keep those titles going. But James figured out how to just create lots of really great sort of satellite projects that you can attach to your magazine, which also create revenue. And then that way your magazine can continue to just sort of be the jewel in the crown, and you can put a lot of work into making it look beautiful, to actually paying writers and photographers enough to produce really great quality content. And I think personally he does that better than anyone in New Zealand. So that's the expertise he was starting to put into Mana. And it took us, you know, a long time, it took us a couple of years to even get it sort of with its head above water, you know what I mean? Like, we didn't lose any money, but we certainly weren't making money hand over fist, even though we were putting all of our considerable time and resources and expertise into it. So the next step was logically to buy it, but then to also invest more money in it so that we could build other things like a digital archive and, you know, like sort of events that you can sort of stage annually, which attract sponsors, and you tie those to the magazine. And it's all this like quite beautiful ecosystem that keeps everything going, but it also means you can have a small core staff that are paid well for what they do and also enjoy what they do without sort of that job insecurity that a lot of the publishing industry experiences.
Yeah, and I guess it's about, you know, a magazine's value isn't necessarily just about what money it's turning over either.
No.
And I wanted to ask you, what do you think were some of the most important stories that you covered during your time as editor?
Oh, there was a few. I think one of the limitations of a magazine, I guess, is you can't send a really great story as widely as you'd like, because we actually published a story about Auckland's housing crisis, reporting on the fact that families were living in cars months and months before that hit the headlines. That was a story by Aaron Smale, and that was a really important story for us, and I do wish that that had gone further. We did a story last year on youth suicide about two specific areas, Northland, which is featuring again in Herald's really great coverage, and also down in Christchurch, where a lot of people were affected after the earthquake. We've done sort of really great investigations into Māori language, over-incarceration of Māori men, you know, all these sort of big-ticket stories that sort of need to be revisited every few years. I think we did quite well by those over the last couple of years.
So you said that you're going to be working with a spin-off. Is that confirmed, or is that sort
of
something?
Yes, I'm already working as a staff writer at the spin-off, then we're hoping to launch our Māori section very soon.
Popular music streaming platform Spotify was accused of filling its playlist with fake artists last week. Reporter Sam Smith investigated these accusations and what they really meant.
Music streaming platform Spotify is under the spotlight this week with accusations they have been filling their curated playlists with fake artists and songs. The allegations have been made by both Vulture.com and MusicBusinessWorldwide.com. The allegations directed at the world's most popular and number one streaming platform are that they encourage and even pay producers to create tracks under untraceable pseudonyms. A quick Google search of the so-called fake artist shows up no information on them in the form of a personal website or links to social media, suggesting these artists are indeed fake. Spotify have denied the allegations, saying they have never created fake artists and put them on Spotify playlists. In a statement, Spotify said they pay royalties for all tracks on Spotify and for everything playlisted. They also added that they do not own rights, are not a label, and that all their music is licensed from rights holders. In their article, Music Business Worldwide revealed a list of 50 names which they claim to be some of the fake artists Spotify are being accused of using in their playlists. This includes artists with names such as Amity Cadet, Mayhem, and Holtana. All the artists on the list have racked up millions of streams on Spotify, 520 million to be precise, which equates to around $3 million in royalties. So what do some of these artists sound like? Well, this is the artist on the list with the most number of streams at 32.4 million, Charles Bolt. A song called Far and Beyond that has racked up over 19 million streams. As you can see, this is quite ambient piano music, of which many of these artists seem to be, meaning that arguably it could be easier to disguise fake artists from real artists, given that by and large, many of these tracks are indeed instrumental. Spotify's playlists are extremely popular and are often the go-to for their users in discovering new music. Their importance is seen in that record labels even pay large amounts of money to have their artists place in these playlists, making the fact fake artists could be replacing real artists on them a bone of contention for record labels. Industry experts appear unsurprised by the news, with many saying that fake artists appearing on Spotify playlists was now common practice and was indeed a bid by the platform to drive down its licensing costs. This might be the case, but it does leave some unanswered questions around the practice. Why is Spotify picking these tracks to appear on its own playlists with such volume and regularity, and ahead of recordings from major and independent labels? What royalty rates are they getting ahead of real artists? And arguably the most important question, is this practice even ethical? It is no secret Spotify is struggling financially, and that any opportunity to pay less to labels or lower its costs will be investigated. However, for a company that is already under attack for not paying artists fairly for access to their content, any move that could be deemed unethical when it comes to ensuring artists get their fair share could be met with a touch of cynicism. It remains to be seen how damaging this will be for Spotify, and we wait with interest as to what will happen next. Sam Smith reporting for 95BFM.
That was this week's Bits. To listen to the full interviews, visit 95BFM.com and check out the BCasts.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/BCasts.